If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Paul Listnick Behind the Curtain. It is the show which takes me away from the world of law and politics you watch me cover on television all the time into the world of theater and the arts and authors. And this is a special day because while several of you, many of you hopefully, have been fans of this show on WGNRadio.com as a podcast, it is today, Saturday, April 5th, when this is airing, that we are now streaming on the new WGN Plus app, which you get on Apple TV or on Roku or on Fire Stick. And so welcome to all of you new viewers who are seeing us as part of the stream, streaming every Saturday at 10:30, repeating again at 4:30 p.m. And on Sundays at 4 p.m., you can catch this show. I couldn't be more honored to have as my premier guest for this WGN Plus premiere show one of my favorite authors, one of the best known authors, I think, in the country, Brad Meltzer, who has written, I don't know, Brad, is it 18 books? I've lost. It depends what category we pick, right? Is it the nonfiction?
It depends on the category. If you add the kids' books into it, it is, I think it's 54, which makes me sound like I need a nap.
Exactly. Well, just kid book alone would make you feel like you'd need a nap. We're going to talk about your two latest. Actually, they're technically the latest. You have a Beatles book coming out in May, which is for kids. So, but you know what? We don't have all day. So I want to focus in on those books that sent me to find you. And that is, of course, your fabulous new book. I've been a fan, not a fan. I follow the JFK conspiracy issue since I was a little kid in 1963. And you've written a book called The JFK Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill Kennedy and Why It Failed. We're going to also talk about your motivational book, Bank Magic. But on the JFK book, we should kick off up front by saying this is not the 1963 assassination we've all read 100 books about.
That's correct. This is 3 years before Lee Harvey Oswald. And just to set the stage, it's 1960. JFK has just been elected. And it's a beautiful Sunday morning in Florida. JFK is on his way to church. And what he doesn't know is that there's a postal worker named Richard Pavlik who's waiting outside for him and wants to kill him and has packed his car with 7 sticks of dynamite. So Pavlik's followed JFK to Florida, into Palm Beach, because he thinks that JFK's security is weaker there, and he's right about that. But he also, what he has to do when JFK comes out, all this guy, assassin, has to do is hit the little trigger mechanism that he's built, and boom, will go the dynamite. And what saves JFK's life that day, I won't ruin it, but it has to do with Jackie. And it is one of the craziest JFK stories you've never heard in your life. And I just realized I just now ruined chapter one of the JFK conspiracy, but that's chapter one. That's the teaser.
Well, I think you have to ruin chapter one. And I won't ruin it by saying it wasn't just Jackie. Somebody else was along with her, but I'll let that go.
Correct.
Yeah, it's a story as much as I have read so much about the assassination of JFK. I never knew this story. There was a reason we didn't learn about it. This would have been front page news even in 1960. It should have been front page news. Why wasn't it?
Yeah, that's the key question. Why do we not know this story? And here's why. It's a huge story in Florida when it happens. It's on the front page of the paper. And it back then took a couple days before everything got nationwide. And on the day that it's about to hit the front page of every newspaper in the country, two planes collide over New York City. And everyone on board these planes dies except for one young kid who becomes the sole survivor. And America becomes obsessed with this boy. Is he going to live? Is he going to die? What's going to happen? It knocks this JFK story off the front page, turns it into a footnote of history, until my friend Josh Mensch and I are like, you know what? This is a really incredible story. We should tell this JFK story that no one knows.
Who's the bigger Mensch, you or Josh Mensch?
I mean, I love the fact that my co-writer is named Mensch. It's like the best truth in advertising I've ever seen in my whole life.
I love it. Yeah, I can think of lots of Yiddish names we can add on for you if you want to. We can do that. We'll do that some other time. You know, it is the story of Richard Pavlik and all that went on. Again, detailed so well, something we never knew. But you encase it within so much of helping us get to know JFK and Jackie and their relationship and so much. Why is it important that we understand who JFK was and his relationship with Jackie as it relates to this assassination attempt?
Because, you know, what we've done with JFK and Jackie Kennedy is we talk about them in really easy terms. We say Jackie is full of grace and, you know, style, and JFK is dashing and handsome. And when we do that, we do them a huge disservice. They're so much more complex than that. And for me, you know, you'll see JFK in World War II. You know, here's a guy who his boat is attacked and blown to pieces, and if men on board die, he's got one guy who's unconscious. He says, put him on my back when they're swimming in the ocean. I'm going to save him. And he puts him on his back, swims to the first island they can find, no food, no water. So JFK says, I'm going to go to another island, swim there by myself, see if maybe that island has more stuff. Or swims there, swims back, says, the other island's better. Again, still no food or water. They're like, sir, what are we going to do with this guy who's unconscious? Put him on my back again. They take a piece of wood, they tie string around it, they have the guy hold on to the wood, and JFK puts the rope in his teeth and swims another mile, no food or water, saving this guy's life. Goes on to save all of his men in the, you know, wild story of how he saves them, and comes home, and they say, you know what, you're done. You're the hero now. You get your discharge. His dad gets him out of the military, and JFK says, no, Dad, I don't want that. World War II is not done. The Nazis aren't beaten. The Japanese aren't beaten. We got to win World War II, and stays back in the military. It's an unbelievable story. And then you tell the story of, you know, what we also see of JFK is we don't hold back. We document all of his affairs with Jackie. We show you that when Jackie goes and hemorrhages when she's giving birth, JFK is nowhere to be found. He's on a plane headed to Florida. And in fact, when they get engaged, one of JFK's friends comes to Jackie and says to her, you know, Jack loves women. Says to her face, he's going to cheat on you. And you're left with this going, you know, is JFK good? Is he bad? Is he amazing because he unleashes hope and has this World War II story? Or is he reckless? And of course, he's a little bit of both. And to me, when we round those people out and show you that they're just like us, then you actually get a better sense of history, and all the kind of fakery that we put around them becomes more clarity. And for me, as a person who loves history, I like seeing the humanity behind everyone. I don't think we need to create fake heroes.
And you create such vivid images of people in all your books. And by the way, in fairness to that friend who told Jackie, you write, he also told Jack Kennedy what he told Jackie.
He knew what he was doing. And it's funny because when I was researching the book, I kept saying to Josh, we were talking about it, and I kept saying, when did they start calling it Camelot? Well, how is this Camelot? Because we all associate Camelot with JFK. Yeah. And then I finally discovered this. The word Camelot is not used until after JFK dies. It's not until after the assassination in 1963 that Jackie grants one interview, just one, exclusively to Life magazine. And she tells the reporter, has him come to her house late at night, and tells the reporter this exclusive story that when JFK was still alive and they were in the White House, one of the things to calm him down when his back was hurting and when he couldn't sleep at night, she used to go to the record player and put on a record one of his favorite songs about a place called Camelot. She's the one who uses that word for the first time. And Jackie's a member of the press at the start of her career. So she's a member of the press. She's hounded by the press, but make no mistake, she's a master of the press. She's the one who puts that word Camelot into the lexicon, writing JFK's legacy before anyone else can. And it's an incredible moment. My wife's favorite parts of these books were the Jackie parts, because Jackie becomes a human being again. And as you said, you're watching this woman go through these horrors and hold it all together. And to me, you know, the one thing you learn is Camelot, it was never a real thing. It was this thing it was a hope we wanted to be, but I'm not sure it ever really existed.
What you also learned from the book, I'm glad you mentioned the comment your wife made, because it was where I was going to go, which is we learned a lot about JFK in this. We learned a lot about Jackie in this. And in fact, the fact that when she did find out about the women in JFK's life, it wasn't as though she screamed and yelled and said, I'm out of this marriage or I'm not going to marry him. She got it. She understood what she was dealing with. We talk about, you know, recent, and I'm not being political with this, but recent first ladies like a Hillary Clinton or a Michelle Obama, who are objectively known to be very smart based on education and other reasons, and they played themselves that way publicly. Jackie, I think, was always seen as this very beautiful, demure woman. The bottom line is she was one smart first lady.
I mean, wait, no one can finish this book and not be so impressed with Jackie. And in fact, the great metaphor for it is her Secret Service agent, the great Clint Hill, who recently passed away. We owe him a great deal for him letting us use these firsthand accounts in this book. And he wrote a great book also with Lisa McCubbin that I should mention. But I will tell you, when we were working on this book, no buts about it, one of the things Clint Hill gets assigned, they say, you're going to go to the White House. You're on protective detail to the first family. He's like, oh my gosh, I'm guarding the president. This is what every Secret Service agent dreams of. And they say to him, no, you don't have JFK. You actually have the first lady. And he's like, oh no. He's like, this is a demotion. He's like, I'm going to guard tea parties. That's what I'm going to be doing. He thinks it's the worst thing that ever happened to him. He doesn't realize in that moment that he gets assigned, of course, to the great Jackie Kennedy. And when they first meet, Jackie used to go on these long walks. She wanted time to herself. She didn't want to be bothered. So, Clint Hill is 50 feet behind her, and she's not saying a word to him. The next day, though, he's just 25 feet behind her. She's still not saying a word. Next day, he's 10 feet behind her. And he had young kids. She had young kids. That's why they think they paired them together. But eventually, she starts talking to him, and this relationship develops that's just so professional and so profound. And you're watching her go through these horrors of her marriage and these ups and downs of her marriage and everything in this world that she doesn't want the glare of the cameras. But of course, the more she pulls away from it, the more people want to grab a piece of her. And you can see him. And what Clint Hill realizes, what the rest of America realizes, is she's a star. She's an incredibly savvy and not just beautiful and not just demure, like you said, but she is so smart in how she operates. And when you read the book, you can't take your eyes off her.
I agree. And one of the other things we learned from Clint Hill in your book, he teaches us a lot about JFK. He's protecting the first lady, but that means JFK is there as well. And so very briefly here, because we'll have to take a break, but you talk about the fact that Clint Hill teaches us three things about JFK from his perspective. One, JFK loved people. Number two, JFK didn't take direction very well when he was told what to do. And number three, he was pretty spontaneous in going to meet with crowds. When it comes to this assassination plot of Richard Pavlik, those could have been really problematic components, because JFK would have been the first to go over and shake Pavlik's hand.
He in fact heads for the fence at one point where Pavlik is standing. And when you had Eisenhower there, Eisenhower, it says on the schedule, get off the plane, get in the car. That's what Eisenhower did. JFK gets off the plane, sees the crowd, and heads for the crowd. And the Secret Service are going, what do we do? And they're like, well, follow him. And my favorite, I'll tell it real quick because I know you got to cut to break, is they get to Florida. All the Secret Service agents are in their suits and they're sweating. And JFK sees them in Palm Beach, Florida, and says, what size shirt are you? Goes inside, grabs one of his own shirts, starts handing them out. And now they're all wearing these short sleeve shirts. They haven't been guarding this guy 24 hours, and they're already wearing his clothes. This is not your father's president. And it's the best part, and it's, of course, the worst part for the Secret Service, as they soon learn.
And I realize that when you talk about the book as you are here, the point you want everybody to know is the title, The JFK Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill Kennedy, Why It Failed. That is what the book is about, but it's so much more. And the fact that we learned so much about the Kennedy administration prior to the administration, if you didn't know how, one thing I didn't know, I knew the power of Joe Kennedy, his father, but there's an explanation you give us as to why Bobby Kennedy becomes the attorney general, and it wasn't because Jack wanted him. And in the end, we also learn what JFK's response to this would-be assassin Richard Pavlik was. Did he say, we got to put this guy to death? That wasn't JFK, but if you want the answers to those, you need to get the book, The JFK Conspiracy. Congratulations, that's a fantastic book. The Beatles book comes out in May of this year, and in case you thought the Beatles was the group's first name, you're wrong. And by the way, if you thought like I did, it was the Silver Beatles, you're wrong. Brad, my brother's a Beatles fanatic. I'll be buying a copy of that book for him, even though he's 70 and it's for kids. In addition, your book, JFK Conspiracy, a whole series of other nonfiction books you've written, Lincoln Conspiracy, Nazi Conspiracy. But you have this inspirational book, I think a tribute to your son, at least born out of your son and his experience, called Make Magic, The Book of Inspiration You Didn't Know You Needed. Give us the history of what led to this book.
Yeah, so I graduated college from the University of Michigan, and I was asked to give the commencement address last year. Now, it's a great honor, right? It's 70,000 people that you speak in front of in the big house. However, Paul, I'm focused on one, my son, who was also graduating that day. And so I got 70,000 people in front of me. I'm looking at one who's in the 14th row on the aisle. I can see my boy. And what I talked about in the speech was the idea that there are things that you can't explain. Science and math can't explain. And that's what magic is, right? There is those things that can't be explained. But when you talk to magicians, there's only four types of magic tricks. Put aside illusions and escapes. There's only four types of tricks. One, you make something appear. Two, you make something disappear. Three, you make two things switch places. And four, you take one thing and you turn it into something else. The hardest trick of all, transformation. And I go through what you need to make appear and what you need to make disappear. And but then I get to the third trick, which is about how you take two things and make them switch places. And I say, here, let's talk about empathy. And that's what empathy is, right? It's when you switch places with someone else and you put yourself in their shoes. And I told this story that I never told publicly before. It was that when I was 13 years old, my dad lost his job. We had to move down to Florida because my grandparents lived there. We had no place to live and we could stay with them for free. So it's six of us in my mom, my dad, my sister, myself, and my two grandparents in a one-bedroom apartment. Everyone in the building's trying to get us kicked out. Everyone wants us to be, you know, they're like, you can't have that many people in one small place. And they want us evicted. And I'll never forget this one neighbor across the hall, directly across my grandmother, goes to my grandmother and says, you know what? Let your family, you use my apartment instead. I'm going to move out and you take my apartment so your family can have a little peace and quiet and won't be evicted. Nicest thing to this day that anyone's ever done for me. And I remember as a kid, her name was Mercy. But when I was younger, I always heard her name as Mercy. And make no mistake, mercy and empathy is what she showed us. And today, cruelty and venom, harshly judging those we disagree with, it's become sport in our culture. But cruelty and venom aren't signs of strength. They're signs of weakness and petty insecurity. And as I said those words in this graduation speech, I felt 70,000 people react. And I remember going, what was that? And when the speech was over, all these people said to me, I want the text of that speech. I want to give that to my son. I want to give it to my grandkids. I want to give it to my niece and nephew. And I've been doing this, Paul, for 27 years. No one's ever asked me for the text of anything I've ever said. And that's what we said, you know what? Publishers started calling and we said, you should make a book about this. And that's where, as a book, Make Magic was born, the ultimate graduation gift, the ultimate present for anyone who needs inspiration in their life. And that's what Make Magic is.
In fact, my son graduated last year from University of Georgia, so he will be getting this book as well. Your son was actually in the, by the way, I encourage everybody not just to get the book of Make Magic and make it a gift, keep it for your own bookshelf, but watch the speech. I hope you don't mind, Brad, but watch the speech.
No, I want people to watch. I love what, you know, I think, you know, this speech for me is my, it's my way of giving my best advice for my son, but also trying to use the power of storytelling to encourage people and see the inspiration around them. You know, the second trick in the book is what you have to make disappear in your life. And everyone always wants to make fear disappear, but I challenge that. And I can tell you that when I was in high school, for 4 years in high school to make money, I worked at the Haagen-Dazs in the Aventura Mall, scooping ice cream. And this woman comes up to me, she starts snapping her fingers at me one day, a customer, and she says, you got to serve me. And I'm like, you know what, ma'am, I'll be right with you. She says, no, you got to serve me now. And I said, ma'am, you know what? You're being rude. I'm not going to serve you. And she screams in my face, Paul, you're going to be working at this miserable ice cream store for the rest of your miserable life. And I said to her calmly, ma'am, if I am working here for the rest of my miserable life, you're still never getting any ice cream. And I used to laugh telling that story going, oh, she didn't even bother me. But it did bother me. It totally got to me because my dad always struggled with money and I was worried that my life was going to have those same financial struggles. But I also realized that woman drove me. She fueled me. And so instead of making your fear disappear, what you have to do is harness your fear, use that fear as rocket fuel. Don't vanquish your critics, prove them wrong. So I love the fact that you can give that message in book form and video form if you watch the speech. But I love the fact that, you know, I wanted my son to have that lesson.
A lot of people want to be novelists and writers. I've written a bunch of books myself and stuff, not the New York Times bestseller you are. But I think one of the greatest things about you is the fact that, I think I have this right, your first book, you received 24 rejection notices. And am I right? It's somewhere behind you. Is it Compliments of Kinko? Is it sitting on your bookshelf?
It's truly, it's right up here behind me. I got 24 rejection letters on my first book. There were only 20 publishers and I got 24 rejection letters.
Some of them wanted to be sure we mean no.
That's right. Make sure I got the point. And it is published by Kinko's. It's bound up here behind me. But I said, if they don't like that book, I'll write another. And if they don't like that, I'll write another. And my girlfriend at the time said to me, then write another one. And she didn't laugh. She just said, you know what? I believe in you. That girlfriend gave me lift. That's why I married her. She's my wife now. And what we have to do in life is you have to find those people that give you lift. That's the first magic trick. What do you have to make appear? That best version of you. And the way you do it is you surround yourself with people who give you that lift.
Sounds like she's the reason that I got to read my very first Brett Meltzer book, which was The 10th Justice.
Yeah, that was my first published book. And I remember when we went out, they told me, I said, how are we going to sell this book? You know, I don't know. And they said, well, if books are different than movies. Books, if someone says to you, you got to read this book. They're sold by word of mouth. So he said, my editor said to me, either one, you know a lot of people, or two, you know a couple people with really big mouths. So let me tell you about my family. My mom and dad, may they rest in peace. My dad used to go into every bookstore. He'd say, I'm here for Brad Meltzer's new book. He's my favorite author. And they're like, Mr. Meltzer, we know he's your son. We know he's your son. And our plan was pretty simple. We're going to unleash my mom and my dad on the universe because they love to, you know, they were good parents and like to talk about their kid. And it worked. And people like you were kind enough. In fact, Chicago was one of the top places where the 10th Justice, and to this day, my books sell. And I know my wife's family's from Chicago, but there's only so many books they can personally buy. And Chicago has been part of our family and part of our book tours for, you know, 27 years now. And kind people like you. I remember the first time someone came at a book signing and I said, do I know you from college in Michigan? No. Do you know you from law school? No. Do I know you from my neighborhood? No. I said, then why are you here? And I finally realized there were so many kind people who have been looking out for us all these years.
Yeah. By the way, people can get you on TV too. Lost History, Decoded. I mean, you're living the dream, Brad. And do you ever look back on your life and realize that you've made magic yourself?
I every day, so I'll tell you this story. Every day, I told you about the 24 rejection letters. So here's a story I never get to tell. They were actually 22 rejection letters, and 23 and 24, the last two, I thought were going to be acceptances. The editors actually said they liked the book and they wanted to like meet with me and then they would decide on what offer they would make. So I went to New York City. I met with them. I'm waiting. My agent says to me, wait by your phone because pre-cell phones back then. And we're going to find out how much they're going to bid. There's going to be a bidding war. And I was in college debt at that point, from law school debt. I was like, I just wanted to know what the dollar amount was that I could get out of debt. And I picked up the phone all excited to hear what they were going to bid. And they said, my agent, I'll never forget, said, sorry, kiddo. And I'll tell you this, Paul, every day that I sit down to write, I replay that moment in my head. Mm. I replay the kind of phone I was holding. It was one of those clear ones. We could see the wires through it because I was high tech at the time. I picture the desk that was on my left, on my right with a swivel lamp like every college kid had. On the other side of me is a bed with no headboard, no, just a box spring and a mattress. I look out over this little terrace that I was there and I see this fire station. I count the doors in my head and then I say those words to myself, sorry, kiddo. And because I never want to ever be thankless. Never ever want to not appreciate what I have. I never want to think I made it, because if I think that, I'm finished. And for 27 years, every day I sit down to write, sorry, kiddo, sorry, kiddo, sorry, kiddo. That's my magic trick.
My magic to you is thank you for being a bigger mensch than your writing partner, Josh. Congratulations on all these books. I can't wait for the next one. And Brad Meltzer, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Paul.